great to be here. I actually grew up just a couple miles north of here, kilometers, I should say. Just Bayview and Highway 7 is where I grew up. Had to stop by and see my old house on the way in today. So it's nice to come back here. I used to always drive by Tyndale all the time when I grew up here. Despite the topic of my paper, maybe this will be disappointing. I don't actually pretend to know a lot about artificial intelligence. Rather, I have spent many years thinking about technology, especially considering the ways in which technology operates within a particular ontology. And what I mean by ontology is a fundamental a way of thinking about what is finally real. Foundational to this paper is the belief that AI is not different in kind to previous technological developments, but that it is different, and perhaps drastically so, in terms of scale and speed. AI is the most recent iteration of the technological way of thinking. Thus, it will be helpful to try to unpack elements of this technological ontology, this technological view of reality, to better understand the way in which AI both reveals and conceals itself. To aid us in this task, we will explore the philosophy of George Parkin Grant. Grant is a Canadian philosopher and theologian from the 20th century. In a not unfamiliar story, a radical encounter with the divine in the midst of the Second World War led him to reject the liberalism of his youth and begin a lifelong journey of theological inquiry. Reflecting on earlier work towards the end of his life, he stated, "It has taken me a whole lifetime to begin to free myself from the language of modernity." His philosophy is marked by the unrelenting pursuit of truth, beauty, and goodness in a technological age. And to better grasp the societal transformations produced by the modern era. In the 1980s, he was recognized as Canada's leading political philosopher. And I'm not sure if I had some slides there or not, but George Grant at times used some aphorisms to shape his thinking and his writing. Oh, here we go. Yeah, if you can advance that to the next slide, or can I do that? Let's see. Oh, I can. So yeah, so this is George Grant. I'm also going to be drawing on Simone Weil, and just full. I was playing around yesterday just to I want to show you their pictures and their dates. But I put their pictures into Gemini and said, create a picture of George Grant and Simone Weil. They never met. They never met. And Gemini, I mean, that's actually really convincing. It's like, will I ever believe anything is true again? I don't know. But there they are having a conversation. That's what I'm going to be doing today. That picture in the middle is not real. So there are four. Grant tended to think in aphoristically, so he had sort of sayings that he would think about a lot. And there's four sayings of his, well, not necessarily of his, but that he used that came from other sources as well, that we're going to try to unpack today. And as I said, we're trying to think about what is the technological mindset? How does it work? And then apply some of those insights to AI. And so the first one comes from an essay that he wrote, Thinking About Technology, where he states that the computer, and here we're expanding it to AI, but he wrote, the computer does not impose on us the ways it should be used. And he tries to unpack that idea. He's very fond of something from Plato as well, from the Republic, where Plato is reflecting on the relationship of the necessary or necessity and the good. And so he's trying to think about the nature of how the necessary and the good really differ. We're going to be trying to unpack that idea too. From Luther, the Heidelberg Disputations, he really reflected a lot again and again throughout his life on Thesis 21 that reads, the theologian of glory says that evil is good and good evil. The theologian of the cross says that the thing is as it is. And that's actually a slight mistranslation of that thesis, but it's the one that he loved. It comes from John Bailey, his book, Knowledge of God. And finally, a phrase from Simone Weil: faith is the experience that the intelligence is enlightened by love. So this paper is going to explore these four aphorisms and try to think about how they help us understand a technological mindset, and then at the end, try to apply that to AI. So by examining the philosophy of George Grant and Simone Weil, we will affirm human relationality and ancient categories of goodness and justice as the standard by which we judge AI. Faith, formed by the cross, where necessity meets what is finally good and true and beautiful, forged with love, can allow us to see what it means to be human in an age of AI. So, beginning with the first phrase, in his essay Thinking About Technology, George Grant presents the following aphorism: the computer does not impose upon us the ways in which it should be used. On the one hand, this just seems like common sense, right? Tools are neutral objects that perform prescribed tasks. But Grant helps us see that this is, in fact, not the case, that there is something that is obscuring and concealing in this statement. While there may be some sense, some limited sense in which the computer, perhaps the gun, does not impose itself, tools are absolutely not neutral. The M16 is not designed to be a back scratcher. Furthermore, the computer is only possible, in fact, all technology is only possible within a certain intellectual framework. For the computer, that framework is the reduction of ideas into bits, right? Computable bits. In other words, the computer only emerges in the context of a particular worldview. And that worldview does impose its limits on us. Our inventions are only possible within the paradigms of knowledge that we share. And in turn, our inventions dictate to us what is possible. Once the infrastructure for the automobile is created, roads, expressways, parking lots, future possibility is dictated, at least in part, by the car. Strip malls fill the landscape. Even if exhaust from the automobile is one of the primary contributors of greenhouse gases slowly killing the planet, the only imaginable solution is a better car, right? Jacques Ellul, who of course writes brilliantly about technology as well, makes this incredible point that the technology of organ transplants are only fully conceivable in the age of the automobile. In order to perform transplants at any scale, numerous healthy young cadavers are required, and automobile deaths actually provide the resources for this to happen, right? Technologies like the computer or the automobile, they can only be produced in a society with the resources to do so, with the framework that makes it possible. And what winds up happening, of course, is that we produce then corporations that become so important and so large within that framework that they're too big to fail, right? Once upon a time, that would have been GM. Now it's Apple. Net worth, conservatively, probably of $4 trillion, right? Google, net worth $3.8 trillion. These companies aren't going anywhere. They're larger than the economies of many countries. So let's return to Grant's statement that we're considering. The computer does not impose upon us the ways in which it should be used. The ways that technology should be used will be formed by the political will of the community which creates it. That is, according to the concept of justice, which forms the community. But the limits of the political imagination and will are already dictated by the same standards of reasoning that enabled the creation of the technology in the first place. Thus, the realm of possibility for should is already contained by the political will of the system. When we talk about the ways we should use our technology, should in this context implies a teleology. Or in other words, should implies owing. We owe blank to what? We owe it to our things to look after them well. I've heard people talk that way. But this is not really what we mean. The machines themselves cannot be the standard of justice. What we really mean is that we owe it to use our machines justly. But whom do we owe, and what standard holds us to account? Thus, the question of values nags at us because it seems clear that there are some uses of technology which go too far. I mean, nuclear weapons that can destroy all life on the planet, genetic intervention in the human germline that can fundamentally change what it means to be human. But when we seek a standard by which to judge the rightness or wrongness of these issues, these very standards are already defined by the system of modern technological thought. One of the places where this difference is brought to light is the question of why should something be made? Ancients respond with goodness, while moderns think in terms of value. This is a really important difference. Whereas goodness is inherent, it's in the thing itself, value is assigned. We decide what is valuable. One of the concerns of the way in which telos is no longer seen as something inherent in the thing itself is that the reason for making is arbitrary. In this sense, technology can become the need to both create and acquire for the sake of creating and acquiring in and of themselves. At one point, Grant quotes Robert Oppenheimer, you know, famous for inventing the nuclear bomb, as saying, "If something is sweet, you have to go ahead with it." Apple and Google, it seems, have perfected this idea through the planned obsolescence of their products. Why get the latest iPhone? Because it's version 17. It's not 16, right? Novelty and efficiency become the ways to assign value that finally justify innovation and technology. Therefore, the question of technology raises absolutely the question of justice. It is a common belief that technology would lead to life improvement and the reduction of suffering. In short, that technology would eliminate injustice. But the introduction of new technology is often ambiguous, hiding both fundamental and long-term implications that come from the use of that new technology. Grant discusses two different accounts of goodness which provide the standard for justice. In the first place, the originating Western conception of justice, or I think I have this quote. Do I have this one up? No, not this one. I'll come back to that in a minute. This is a quote from Grant. The originating Western conception of goodness is of that which meets us with the overriding claim of justice and persuades us that in desiring obedience to that claim, we will find what we are fitted for. So you can hear in that a justice here, and if you don't know Grant or you can't hear it yet, Grant is thoroughly Platonic in how he thinks. And so justice here is an objective external claim that meets us, and in responding to it, we find our teleology, right? We find what we are fitted for. Thus, the standard of goodness is objective and external. We owe justice in response to the claim of goodness in our lives. This contrasts with the modern conception of goodness, which is of our free creating of richness and greatness of life and all that is advantageous thereto. The standard of goodness in this account is dependent and provisional on what we create. Thus, it is also subjective. This has important implications for justice. This leads to the belief that we freely create value. Furthermore, we have the freedom through technology to make what we want to happen. And here is, I think, the most important transformation. In this account of value, goodness becomes mastery, which masquerades as freedom. So, in other words, what we think, what we create is itself good, already inherent in the creation, And the point of that creation is control, is dominance, is power, is mastery. And so the end result here is that we cease to have values that cause us to place limitations on society because we do not have any common belief that restrains us. This leads into our second saying, Grant's interest on the distance between the necessary and the good. And this insight comes from Simone Weil, but originates with Plato. And Plato's comment comes in the context of his criticism of the sophists. In this passage, Socrates accuses the sophists of pandering and bad faith. So this is a longer quotation from the Republic, so I've got it here for you. No, and so this is Plato writing, it's Socrates speaking, and he's talking about these the kind of the popular philosophers of his day that he thought pandered for perhaps popularity or to be well known and to be accepted. So he says of them, knowing nothing in truth about which of these convictions and desires is noble or base or good or evil or just or unjust, he, the sophist, applies all these names following the great animal's opinions, calling what delights it good and what vexes it bad. He has no other argument about them, but calls the necessary just and noble, neither having seen nor being able to show someone else how much the nature of the necessary and the good really differ. Due to this inauthenticity, the sophist has no capacity to truly understand the distance between necessity and the good. Confusion of these two planes leaves open the possibility of thinking that historical necessity is in fact the standard of goodness. And so what we're really talking here is about the idea of progress. The idea of progress as historical necessity does have Christian roots, but thinking of it in this kind of historical secular way is a distortion. While the Christian conceives of the unfolding of history as the divinely ordained process of salvation leading to the kingdom of God, secularized history is the process of progress leading to a very different idea of salvation, the kingdom of man. The hope is that progress is the path to the reduction or even the elimination of suffering and evil. Aren't we just continually hopeful that the latest technological advance will finally resolve whatever challenge we face? Right? Surely the judicious use of AI will finally help us to cure cancer, right? Right? In the myth of progress, technological advancement is inevitable. But when necessity is perceived as good, it confuses the means for the end. More than that, as we've already seen, it makes us unable to recognize the true end in terms of justice and goodness. Goodness, in terms of value, is found in the technological drive itself. So there are important moral consequences for this. A reduction of goodness to necessity is really expressing the idea of the will to power, which is Nietzsche's idea. This allows the absurd possibility that oppression and cruelty can come to be seen as finally good in some sense. The screams of the tortured child can be justified by the achievements of history. Conflating necessity with goodness is like imagining our worldly power is really divine power at work. This is the root of our exclusivist and imperialist tendencies, the tyranny of the strong over the weak. This is what happens when power becomes the arbiter of truth. This is a grave theological error, akin to conflating the ontological distance between creator and creature. Grant's reflections on the relationship of the necessity and the good, or the necessary and the good, filter through the work of Simone Weil. Weil contemplates goodness and necessity in light of suffering and affliction. Necessity produces a rare opportunity. For Weil, the mechanical necessity of reality is not open for our manipulation. Necessity is something to which we submit and learn obedience, even in the face of great suffering or affliction. Affliction, and if you know Weil's work at all, she writes a lot about affliction. For those of you who don't know Simone Weil, Simone Weil is absolutely fascinating figure. She's a French philosopher who's absolutely brilliant. She is part of a very secular Jewish family growing up, and becomes absolutely enthralled with Catholicism and has a divine encounter as well, but never actually finally converts to Catholicism. She is not willing to accept that salvation resides in the church itself. And so she never converts, but she becomes something of a modern Catholic mystic who isn't Catholic, if that makes any sense at all. She's an absolutely fascinating figure, and her writing is beautiful. She suffered a lot through her life, especially from these terrible, terrible migraines. And so she writes very deeply about suffering. And she's a beautiful author, and she's wonderful to read. So for Weil, affliction or malheur is a terrible force with the potential to turn a human being into an object, or that is, a thing. Affliction is not a symptom of sinfulness, but due to the blind mechanism of the universe, affliction presents the opportunity to consent to the absence of God. Got a couple of quotes here from Weil. Affliction makes God appear to be absent for a time. More absent than a dead man, more absent than light in the utter darkness of a cell. A kind of horror submerges the whole soul. During this absence, there is nothing to love. The soul has to go on loving in the emptiness, or at least to go on wanting to love, though it may only be with an infinitesimal part of itself. Affliction or suffering leads to what she calls decreation, the renunciation of self, or the overcoming of ego selfishness, whereby the soul can become the conduit of God's love. And she thinks in kenotic terms quite a bit. He, meaning Jesus, emptied himself of his divinity. We should empty ourselves of the false divinity with which we were born. Once we have understood we are nothing, the object of all our efforts is to become nothing. It is for this that we suffer with resignation. It is for this that we act. It is for this that we pray. May God grant that I become nothing. And so far as I become nothing, God loves himself through me. For Weil, it is this suffering and subsequent decreation that allows true love of neighbor to see them as they are. This is justice in light of supernatural love. The very least, this points towards the necessity of struggle in the formation of becoming human that is required for learning. And as we come back to, you know, think about AI at the end of this paper, that's one of the things that I think AI, as a professor and as I struggle with this in the classroom, that's what it takes away, is any kind of notion of the struggle of formation. It removes that. The infinite distance between the good and the necessary is established by God's choice to abdicate his power so that we might exist. Therefore, by accepting the crushing weight of necessity, where we participate in the very same movement of kenotic or self-emptying love that God enacted in creation and Christ enacted on the cross. The necessary and the good are bridged in the paradoxical love of God. For both Grant and Weil, the only place this happens is the cross of Christ. Right? So we have this tendency to think of historical progress as necessary, and then we name it good. But this profound insight that I'm trying to unpack, and maybe it's a little dense, but what both Grant and Weil say is the only place where that which had to happen was absolutely necessary, and goodness, where those two things actually meet, is only in the cross. That's the one place where that which is necessary is actually finally completely good in every sense, right? And that what we do is we constantly take that narrative and think that what we do is good and necessary, right? And it's very different. And so then we come to the third aphorism from Martin Luther, who famously distinguishes between the theology of glory and the theology of the cross. He first makes this crucial distinction in his Heidelberg Disputation of 1518. Luther's spiritual anxiety before this famous breakthrough consisted in his terrible fear of God's righteousness as wrath and the experience of his own deep sinfulness. He suffered until he was able to see that God's righteousness is God's free gift to sinners received through faith. And this breakthrough is captured by Luther's distinction between the theology of glory and the theology of the cross. The theology of glory seeks to discover God through the display of his divine power, majesty, wisdom, and glory as it is manifested in creation by means of human reason. This implies that it is possible for humans to reach God through their own ability, be it moralism or philosophy. In contrast to that, which of course Luther rejects all of that, in contrast, Luther offers the theology of the cross. The theology of the cross recognizes that we cannot find God, that God reveals himself to us. Moreover, the place of God's revelation is uniquely in the crucifixion of Jesus. God reveals himself in the weakness and the scandal of the cross. And there's an important sense in which God is hidden from us. You cannot find God in displays of power and glory. Rather, God is revealed in weakness and hidden in suffering. It is impossible to know God apart from the cross. And this revelation of God in the suffering and crucifixion of Christ is a matter of faith. In the Heidelberg Disputation, Luther gives a number of theses that define this insight. Thesis 21 deeply shapes Grant's thinking. The translation of this thesis that most impresses Grant is actually a mistranslation. It comes from John Bailey. The theologian of glory says that evil is good and good evil. The theologian of the cross says that the thing is as it is. Grant's use of this thesis coincides with his contemplation of the distance between the necessary and the good. By conflating the necessary and the good in terms of the modern age, believing the myth of progress, the modern paradigm is in constant danger of calling evil good and good evil. Rather, we must see the thing as it is. We must unmask the hidden ontological implications of technology. By calling evil good and good evil, a theology of glory trivializes sin and the depths of evil and suffering in the world. It even risks making God a tame confederate for our petty adventurings. That's one of Grant's phrases. I like that. That we risk making God a tame confederate for our petty adventurings. Rather, God is absent or is hidden in the suffering. This requires that we fully face and name reality by saying that the thing is as it is. This requires us to see and name AI as it is, apart from any myth of progress. And we must reject at all costs any form of thought which obscures the true nature of the thing by calling good evil and evil good. A theology of the cross insists that God is finally revealed in the suffering of Christ on the cross. And this is the model of discipleship that we must struggle to embody. Beginning theologically in this place allows us to maintain the ontological difference of creator and creature, remaining honest about our identity and role in the world. Faith and the multiversity is Grant's mature reflection on these issues. The modern scientific paradigm that we have been considering is the offspring of this kind of modern objective knowledge. In the modern turn, we, the subject, summon before us objects or things to question the reasons why it is as it is. The foundation for this work is a profound Cartesian skepticism. We doubt and demand answers of objects we study. Objects become things to be mastered. This process obscures the idea of beauty, goodness, and justice by burying them behind utilitarian usefulness. Only as anything stands before us in some relation other than the objective can we learn of its beauty from its beauty. As a response, Grant proposes that we consider Simone Weil's aphorism that faith is the experience that the intelligence is enlightened by love. Rather than beginning with skepticism that demands answers, faith in this regard begins with trust formed by love. What might it mean to think again as the ancients did, that knowledge is really a form of love rather than a form of mastery? To love in this sense is to consent to the fact that there is authentic otherness and that we love this otherness because it is beautiful. Rather than us confronting the world so as to control it, we are confronted by the world that is beautiful and respond in love. We may yet rediscover that goodness cannot be reduced to usefulness, but it is found in discovering what we are fitted for. In Grant's Platonic vision, human beings are fitted to live well together in communities and to try to think openly about the nature of the whole. Once again, we must redevelop relational and transcendent ways of seeing that have the power to change our thinking. Our resistance to the technological paradigm begins with our ontology, with our fundamental view of what is finally real. So what might it look like to think about AI in light of a faith informed by love, which rejects the conflation of the good with the necessary, and see the ultimate revelation in the mystery of the cross? How might this enable us to see the thing as it is? Well, on the one hand, I feel very ill-equipped to pass judgment in this regard, here are four at least preliminary insights that may help us to think about a way forward. First of all, hopefully we can finally be finished with the idea of the neutral tool. Of course, humans use tools all the time, often in positive ways, but tools are not neutral in any way. Technology is a paradigm of knowing, not simply a set of instruments. Moreover, tools change us as we use them. I've heard many times in recent months that AI is transforming work with demands of productivity and efficiency. There's nothing new here. This is a function of the technological way of knowing. Along with a new way of knowing, it often produces experts, a technical clergy, and produces new social relations. Objects or tools make demands of us that lead to profound change in our environment, and none of this is neutral. The biggest issue facing us with the increased use of AI is the need for new sources of power on a much larger scale than before. How can we meet this need while addressing environmental and communal concerns? Can we find a way to truly use AI without dramatically increasing global warming? Probably not. Can we find a way to use AI without dramatically transforming the power grid, placing its control in private companies? In the US, that's the solution to everything. That's where I live now. Public utilities are important, of course. By sharing the cost, we supposedly guarantee shared access. Radically disproportionate use and profit of shared public utilities challenges our political will. This is a really important conversation. Privatization cannot be the answer, which will only lead to increased lack of access for the marginalized. So we have to, when thinking about AI, we have to realize that it's not just a neutral tool that'll help us do things better. It's a whole way of thinking and doing and living that has implications beyond just the efficiency it offers, which leads to its own questions, but produces a whole system that leads us into difficult moral questions. And we have to be aware of that as we move forward. Secondly, hopefully we can be done with the myth of progress as well. What we are talking about is profound change, not necessarily progress. All change comes with intended and unintended consequences. At the outset, we cannot predict the implications of these consequences. It is a grave risk to continue to primarily think of technological change as progress that conflates necessity and the good. I mean, I'm sure you hear this. We have to move forward. I hear this in my institution all the time. We have to move forward. We have no choice. We can't be left behind. Change driven by fear leads to increased risks. As Christians, Grant and Vey want us to see that the only place where necessity and the good meet is the cross. To see it otherwise is both to misunderstand and make light of human suffering. To see it otherwise is to risk being a theologian of glory who calls the good evil and the evil good. And finally, if this analysis hits the mark in any way, we are left with very practical questions of how, when everyone is working out of a very particular intellectual paradigm, is it at all possible for us to see and live in a world from a very different perspective? What does it mean to live by faith, where faith is the intelligence enlightened by love? We must emphasize the importance of human relationality in our time, especially by embracing authentic otherness and countercultural practices of Sabbath and rest. We must learn again the difference between entertainment that distracts, if you've seen any AI-produced videos, you'll know what I mean, and art that truly transforms. I want to be clear that I'm not saying never use AI. We live within the paradigm of the technological. Resistance comes in many different forms. One form is refusing to participate. Another form comes with eyes wide open participation. Knowing that I've been thinking about this in terms of the parable of the dishonest manager in Luke 16. Knowing that his fraud has been exposed, the dishonest manager doubles down in bribing his master's debtors to think better of him. And Jesus' response to this action is fascinating. Jesus says, I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into the eternal homes. And again, Jesus says in this passage, if then you have not been faithful with the dishonest wealth, who will entrust you to true riches? So, you know, out of this parable and thinking, like the question rises, like, how can we be faithful with AI, which I see kind of as the parallel of dishonest wealth? Finally, there's the tantalizing passage at the very end of Grant's essay on faith and the multiversity. He references Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche's well-known argument that Western Christianity, by giving rise to the rationalism which produced modern science, created the conditions for its own demise. In other words, Christianity produced its own gravediggers. As you may famously know, Nietzsche said, God is dead. But perhaps the same can be said for modern science. By conflating the necessary and the good, by excluding love, or by reducing love to desire and technique, this paradigm creates the necessary conditions for its own emptiness. And perhaps as this emptiness is revealed, new possibilities for relationality emerge. Grant writes, the web of necessity, which I think I might have this one too. Let me see. Oh, maybe not. The web of necessity, which the modern paradigm of knowledge lays before us, does not tell us that God is dead, but reminds us of what Western Christianity seemed to forget in its moment of pride. How powerful is the necessity which love must cross? Christianity did not produce its own gravediggers, but the means to its own purification. Faith, formed by the cross, where necessity meets what is truly good and true and beautiful, forged with love, can allow us to see what it means to be human in an age of artificial intelligence. Thank you.